against Barshefsky. Mr. Oberhauser, not a time to get comfortable.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Paul Oberhauser and I represent the appellants, defendants David Barshefsky and Jonathan Whistler in this case. There are six arguments raised in the appellant's brief, and in view of the time, I'll just address a couple of them and refer the court to the briefs for the others. My clients are two of over 25,000 persons caught in DirecTV's broad net. These 25,000 plus people were all sued by DirecTV for signal interception because their names appeared on mailing lists as persons being that had purchased smart card technology. The type of devices my clients freely admit they purchased are smart card reader-writers, which are electronic devices that can read a smart card. A smart card is the size of a credit card and has a microprocessor and holds data. DirecTV's well-paid expert witness testified at trial that because DirecTV decided to use smart card technology in its satellite dish receivers, smart card technology can be used as one component to construct a system that is capable of decrypting DirecTV signals.
The problem that strikes me with the argument you're now presenting, indeed with much of your brief, is that it reads like a presentation to the jury, and the jury obviously drew different inferences, right? There was also evidence in the record that your client bought these devices from a site that markets them as useful for piracy, belonged to bulletin boards that discussed means, ways and means of using them in signal piracy, and the jury drew the inference that your clients knew very well that these would be used for piracy. Now the question is, why was the jury not able to draw that inference?
Well, let me start by answering that question with respect to Mr. Barshefsky. And it's interesting to note the different verdicts reached by the jury. Mr. Whistler was found liable for interception under both 18 U.S.C. 2520 and 47 U.S.C. 605. Mr. Barshefsky, however, was found liable for interception under 47 U.S.C. 605, but not, repeat, not liable for interception under 18 U.S.C. 2520.
Yes, the jury obviously concluded that he had distributed all four of the devices and not used any himself, and that makes the verdict entirely consistent.
I understand your point, but that raises a different issue. These claims require that DirecTV be a party aggrieved. That means there must have been some interception somewhere by somebody with respect to the devices that were purchased through Mr. Barshefsky. The evidence was that he merely allowed a friend, Joe Foltz, who had done some work on his house, to use his credit card to order the smart card devices. They were shipped to his house. Mr. Foltz came and picked them up.
Let's say that was his testimony. The jury wasn't obliged to believe that.
For Mr. Barshefsky to have been found liable under 605, it must have been able to conclude that somebody, somewhere, used these devices to intercept, and there was simply no evidence of that. It was undisputed that at the time of the purchase, Mr. Barshefsky did not have the components necessary to intercept. There's no evidence about what happened to Mr. Foltz or what he did with them. It's in pure speculation to guess as to what happened with these devices that Mr. Foltz picked up from Mr. Barshefsky. I'd also like to turn briefly with regard to the claims against Mr. Whistler. As you know, 18 U.S.C. 2520 exempts from liability any communications related to an aeronautical communication system. Here, the testimony was uncontradicted. DirecTV's system is an aeronautical communication system. Therefore, the trial court should have granted Mr. Whistler's motion for judgment on the evidence. The judgment against Mr. Whistler also should be reversed because it is undisputed that he was an authorized DirecTV subscriber. Now, the way DirecTV's system works is that if you're an authorized subscriber, you can select premium shows, and afterwards you get a bill for them. However, you are authorized to watch the shows in the first place. If you don't pay your DirecTV bill, that doesn't make you liable for intercepting the signals in the first place. The most you're going to be liable for is not paying your DirecTV bill.
Why not? Signal A is scrambled, signal B is not. You use a pirate device to unscramble signal A. Why isn't that a source of liability? I'm completely flummoxed by the fact that paying for signal B entitles one to use a pirate device to unscramble signal A.
Well, who is authorized or not authorized should be determined according to whether or not the device that is used to receive it is authorized. For example, I'm not a DirecTV subscriber, but my next-door neighbor is. Suppose I go to my neighbor's house to watch the Super Bowl on DirecTV. Am I liable for intercepting the signal because I am not an authorized subscriber?
No signal has been intercepted.
I beg your pardon?
No signal has been intercepted in your hypothetical.
Agreed.
The question is whether it's been used for a public performance. I assume that's an interesting question of the interpretation of a license.
Well, I don't think that issue is before the court, but I think the focus of who is authorized must turn on the question of whether or not there is a DirecTV subscription for the equipment that receives the signal. And it's undisputed that Mr. Whistler had a DirecTV subscription at all times. In fact, he didn't even cancel his subscription until after he was sued by DirecTV. I guess it doesn't pay to be a loyal customer anymore. I'd also like to just briefly touch on the issue of the Rule 11 sanctions that is addressed in the briefs. As noted in that brief, DirecTV filed a motion after the trial was over for a protective order, seeking an order of really unprecedented scope.
Before us.
I beg your pardon?
How is this question before us, since the district judge never ruled on it?
The magistrate judge denied the motion.
Exactly. But we review decisions of the district judges. No one asked the district judge to rule on this question. No ruling was ever made, and it's therefore not within the scope of the judgment that's been appealed. How could we pass on it?
This court has ruled in the video views case. Let me state this. DirecTV.
In video views, and in all the cases dealing with question whether failing to protest within 10 days waives appellate review, the district court actually ruled, but without any legal argument from one of the parties. As I understand the situation here, the district judge never actually ruled on this at all. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, then I don't understand how it would be within the scope of our jurisdiction.
It is still a ruling of the lower court.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that we can review a ruling of a magistrate judge that was never passed on by the district judge?
I think that the video views case is easily distinguished.
The video views case did not involve that situation. I ask again, do you have any authority for the proposition that we can review a ruling of a magistrate judge when the district judge never entered a decision on the question at all?
I would argue that the video views case permits that.
Do you have any authority? You can answer no, or you can say, I don't know, but you can't answer video views because I've already told you the district court ruled in that case.
And given your limitations, I would have to answer no, although I disagree respectfully with your reasoning, and we've reserved the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Overhauser. Mr. Zwillinger.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Zwillinger. I appear on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee DirecTV. Let me just, before I get to the merits, note that this is the first civil case to reach this court raising the issue of liability for civil parties under USC, under the Communications Act and the Wiretap Act. And although most of the DirecTV cases in the district courts in the circuit have been resolved, a decision from this court on all of the issues raised by Mr. Overhauser would be helpful guidance should a second wave of piracy cases become necessary. There are six issues that the appellants raised in the brief, but given...
Should a second wave of piracy cases become necessary? Do you expect piracy to end tomorrow?
Thankfully, Your Honor, we are in a moment where DirecTV is not suffering from satellite piracy, but we expect there will be a time in the future when it happens again.
You've updated your encryption standards?
A combination of legal measures and encryption, Your Honor. I want to focus the court's attention on the standing argument that Mr. Overhauser raised, which is the question of whether a provider of direct-to-home satellite services has standing to bring a claim against a person who violates 47 U.S.C. 605A or E4. And he basically makes two arguments. He says that 605A doesn't apply to satellite transmissions. It only applies to radio communications. He made that point in the brief. What I wanted to point this court to is that he actually conceded that argument in the lower court below. In their motion for summary judgment, which you can find on page 25 of the second appendix, the defendants conceded that satellite communications are communications sent by radio. So that leaves only the question under 605E4. DirecTV has standing under 605E4 for two reasons. One is the plain wording of the statute. 605E4 makes it illegal to distribute any electronic device knowing or having reason to know that it is primarily useful in the decryption of direct-to-home services.
I'm a little puzzled by this use of terminology. I don't understand what standing has to do with this. DirecTV suffers injury in fact. If we award it damages, it's compensated. Isn't the right question whether DirecTV has a private right of action under the statute?
I think that is an alternative way of looking at the question.
Some way of looking at it, since standing is perfectly clear.
I agree with you, Your Honor. Some courts have looked at it as a standing issue. We think it's a statutory interpretation issue of any person aggrieved. So I agree with the court. The question is whether DirecTV is aggrieved. And the answer here, of course, is yes. 605E3A says that any person aggrieved by a violation of paragraph 4 may bring a civil action, and DirecTV has a proprietary interest in the communication sent by satellite. The appellants make an argument, which has been unsuccessful in several other circuits, that 605D6 limits person aggrieved to those people who manufacture a satellite cable programming equipment. That's clearly not the right interpretation of D6. D6 is a term of expansion, and it says for purposes of E4, the people who have a right to bring a claim includes those who manufacture satellite cable programming equipment, but not it doesn't limit it to that.
Speaking of proper or improper interpretations of the statute, if you would address the Rogers case and whether that needs to be overruled.
Sure,
on the
certainly.
Question of damages and whether they're discretionary or mandatory, and whether that was a proper interpretation of the may language right. In the statute.
Certainly.
Yes, I have the same concern since the Rogers issue has come up in four other circuits since we handed it down, and the view is 4-0 that Rogers is incorrect. So what should we be thinking about this question?
I don't think this is a case to visit Rogers again for several reasons. First, I don't think anything in Judge Hamilton's opinion awarding damages makes it clear that he hadn't decided that damages wouldn't be appropriate except for Rogers.
I thought the district judge was perfectly clear that he viewed these damages as legally obligatory, that he had no discretion to exercise. That is, of course, the holding of Rogers, and it was the holding that was rejected by the four other circuits. It seems to me clearly presented. So what's next?
Well, before we get there, though, Your Honor, I think Judge Hamilton said that once he decided to award damages, there was no choice about the amount of damages he could award.
Yeah, well, that's his holding. That's the holding of Rogers. And the problem is the statute says the court may assess as damages whichever is the greater of. So it sounds from the statute like this amount is a ceiling, but Rogers held, and the district court proceeded, as if it were a floor. There's a big difference between a ceiling and a floor in this room, about 20 feet.
Well, which I would argue, Your Honor, whichever is the greater of is not a ceiling. Whichever is the greater of is a floor. That is, whichever is the court would award whichever is the greater of $100 per day or $10,000. The court has no discretion to go under that.
What is the meaning of the word may?
Ordinarily, I would say may has a permissive interpretation. But why this court was right in Rogers is that may cannot have a permissive interpretation when combined with the phrase whichever is the greater of. If we stop for a moment, Your Honor.
No, whichever is the greater of, one would think, just as an original matter, whichever is the greater of says you look at A and B, and your ceiling is whichever is the higher of A and B. The other possibility is whichever is the lesser of. That is, your ceiling would be the lesser of A or B. The statute says the ceiling is whichever is the higher of A or B. But then we have the may, which seems to say, and that sets the cap, and then you can set damages in that range.
But I would argue, Your Honor,
that is, of course, what 12, I guess 13 judges, since there was a dissent in Rogers, that, you know, among federal judges, it's now 13-2 on this question.
Which A ceiling or floor, however, implies that there's a range. Whichever is the greater of does not allow a range. The court doesn't say you may go, the statute doesn't say you may go up to whichever is the greater of. It says whichever is the greater of. That is, there is no discretion.
Your reading is the statute reads as if it said the court must assess as damages whichever is the greater of.
My argument.
But may and must are usually thought of as very different words.
I agree that may is normally read permissively, but you don't read may permissively where doing so would create an absurd result or is internally inconsistent. And my argument is it is internally inconsistent, if I might explain, Your Honor. Whichever is the greater of doesn't allow for any discretion. So even if may were a permissive word, the opposite of may would be may not. If may should be interpreted permissively, it would mean the court may or may not award whichever is the greater of $100 a day or $1,000 or $10,000.
No, that's where I get lost. Whichever is the greater of tells you to compute each of these things and then choose between A and B depending on which is the greater. It doesn't tell you whether you must award all of it or part of it.
I would say it tells you you must award the larger of. Whichever is the greater of is not a...
That's the problem. Your argument would be right. The statute said must.
My argument is that you cannot interpret the word may in its normal permissive sense when combined with the language whichever is the greater of, because it reads out whichever is the greater of from the statutory interpretation. That is, we're presented with the exact same situation we were in Rogers. And this court has said that it doesn't take lightly overturning another precedent of this court unless there are special circumstances or a compelling justification. And I would argue there is no special circumstance. There is no compelling justification here. What Congress did here is very ambiguous. They took the word shall and changed it to may. Ordinarily, I would agree with the court that that would mean this permissive. But they left in the language whichever is the greater of. So a sentence that says you may award the larger of 1,000 or 10,000 doesn't give you a choice. It's you have to award the 10,000. You can't award the lesser of. And I can't find another statute where the word may is combined with the phrase whichever is the greater of in the entire United States Code. So what the court said in Rogers was, given this change, we're looking for some evidence of congressional intent to demonstrate that Congress intended to make this mandatory, and we can't find it. And absent any evidence of it, we are not going to change the meaning of the statute from mandatory to permissive. And I would say we're in the same situation today. Yes, four other circuits have come to different conclusion, but that is not a special circumstance that justifies overruling the Rogers case.
Mr. Willinger, can I return you for a moment to the issue of the sufficiency of the actual interception?
Sure.
Now, as has been noted earlier, Mr. Barshevsky testified he no longer had the necessary equipment, but Chief Judge Eastbrook appropriately noted that jury's free to disregard that. And with Mr. Whistler, he admitted to the posting. So, but neither side seems to make clear to me what exactly, what kind of equipment and software is required to access the signal.
Very little equipment and software is required other than what generally comes from a DirecTV subscription. That is, the main piece of equipment you need is a dish on the roof of your house.
Understood.
You need an IRD or a set-top box. You need the access card that comes with the set-top box. And then you need a device, like the ones that were purchased in this case, that has a capacity to unloop or glitch the card. And then you need the firmware, which came on the card. That was the reference to SU2 in the record. And then the final piece you need is a piece of software that was available throughout the Internet, even from the websites that that Mr. Barshevsky and Mr. Whistler were members of. That's it.
As you presented it to us just now, that was presented at trial.
That was presented at trial. That was presented at trial through the testimony of Mr. Whalen and Mr. Gatliff. So while it would be helpful to have a ruling from the court of the quantum of evidence necessary to overcome summary judgment, this isn't that case. They asked the court to review the denial of summary judgment, but there was a trial on the merits. And the evidence at trial was more than sufficient. This isn't a a possession case where all we had was that they had purchased the device. We have evidence that they purchased the device, that at one point at least they had all the necessary equipment, that they were members of piracy forums. Mr. Whistler had made a post on the piracy forum. Mr. Barshefsky had visited the piracy forum between 10 and 20 times. So there was more than enough evidence for a reasonable jury to infer that there was interception in this case.
I wonder why, unless these people who were running this pirate's den were interested in helping DirecTV win its legal actions, you would choose a title like that for your forum as opposed to Forum to Assist DirecTV Users Having Installation Troubles or something like that.
You're commenting on the ubiquity of piracy several years ago when people thought DirecTV was doing nothing about it and people were quite brazen in their naming. The only other issue I'd like to address is this aeronautical communications issue, because I think it's a bit of a red herring. It's really just a question of whether DirecTV signals are covered by 18 U.S.C. 2511 or whether there's this novel exception for aeronautical communications that applies. And I think this court would be clear that this is a question of law, not a question of fact. Mr. Whalen's answer to a trick question at trial on whether this was an aeronautical communication system doesn't govern the day. Every court that has considered whether DirecTV's communications are protected by 2511 has found that they are, and there are the majority of circuits on that. We know that also because the statute specifically makes reference to satellite communications when it carves out an exception for unencrypted satellite communications. So I don't think there's anything to the aeronautical communications issue. If I could just return briefly to the issue that seems to be most troubling to the court, which is the Rogers v. Wood issue. I would again ask the court to take a close look at whether there are compelling circumstances to overrule the circuit precedent, because the combination of May...
How about nobody agreeing with us?
What's that?
How about no sister circuit agreeing?
As this court has written before, it's still the determination of this circuit to make its own decisions, Atchison versus Topeka. And I think the answer here is that since this is a matter of statutory construction, Congress is free to have the last word on this and to amend the statute in a way to make it clear. Congress muddled it up the first time, and I think it's clear that we don't know exactly what Congress intended without any reference in the legislative history. I think it's very odd to combine the word may with whichever is the greater of. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Overhauser?
Bearing in mind that rebuttal should be confined to the points issued on the prior examination, my comments will be very brief. I'd like to address your question, Judge Flom, about what equipment is needed. There was a good deal of testimony on this from Mr. Whalen, DirecTV's expert. Two of the additional items that are required to construct a system to intercept include a modified DirecTV access card, special software, and there's no evidence that either of these defendants ever had either of these two items. In addition, Mr. Whalen testified that you need special training to do this, how to put all the pieces together and to do it. And in fact, Mr. Whalen testified as DirecTV's expert that even he didn't know how to construct such a system. And with all due respect, in view of that, I continue to contend that there wasn't sufficient evidence to find that the defendants were able to construct such a system. With regard to the issue of aeronautical communication system, the witness testified that DirecTV was an aeronautical communication system. The witness that testified to that was DirecTV's own expert on the issue of DirecTV's signals. If he didn't know, who would? Moreover, if DirecTV felt the testimony of its own witness was ambiguous or required any explanation, they had ample opportunity to examine their own witness further on the record. DirecTV failed to do so. As a result, the uncontradicted testimony at trial was that DirecTV's system is an aeronautical communication system. Therefore, the exemption of 2520 applies, and the trial court erred by not granting Mr. Whistler's motion on the evidence at the close of DirecTV's case. Finally, with respect to the Rogers decision, I concur that I think this would be an excellent opportunity for the Seventh Circuit to readdress Rogers. The damages that these defendants were held liable for are astronomical, in my view, compared to the potential triviality of the value of whatever signals they may have received. I mean, a DirecTV subscription costs $15 or $19 a month, and they were hit with damages in the amount of $40,000 plus. It's out of sync with the remaining circuits, and I respectfully request that the court reassess Rogers. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.